Well, we're going to try a little something different. It's Mike Salt and Tom Wassel. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Mikey.
We're going to try a little one-off podcast in honor of a person who meant a great deal to both of us, although neither of us have ever met him. Have been in the same building with him, I guess, on a number of times.
Four times for me.
I think I counted seven for me, or is it eight, something like that. But when Neil Peart, and I've said Peart my whole life. I know I've heard it as Peart, and I know that's what they say, and I've heard Getty introduce him as Peart, and so I'm probably wrong to keep saying Peart, but it's really hard for me to make the change. I just assume it's accent, and that I'm okay saying Peart.
I always thought it was a Canadian-American thing.
Yeah.
It's like saying Z instead of Z. They say YYZ.
Exactly.
We say YYZ. It's just kind of the way it is.
So I'm going to assume I'm okay saying Peart. Neil Peart passed away last week on January 7th. When I was texted the news from a coworker here, and I almost fell out of my chair. Yeah. I mean, I know I talked to you soon afterwards. You and I have spent, I don't know how many hours talking about Rush, playing Rush music together, and kind of want to go through some of those memories here on this, just a tribute to Neil and to a band that has meant so much to both of us.
Yeah, I think, look, unfortunately, we're losing so many musicians from that generation, and I'm a classic rock guy. You are too. I mean, I like David Bowie a lot, but when those deaths happen, they don't affect me the way this one did. I really felt like, because of my relationship with not just him, but with the band and their music, and when I picked up on them in life, I was in about junior high, I really felt like I had lost a friend. Like a friend had passed away, and it was very sad. It was unexpected. I was as surprised at my grief as I was, you know, just sad about the thing. But you know what? Ever since then, I've been listening to their music nonstop.
Same.
Yeah, and I'm happy to be doing this here.
Yeah, I was hoping this would be a little cathartic for both of us. And, you know, it's interesting. Facebook's got its own problems, but it's so interesting the way it picks up on things that you're interested in and then just keeps delivering it to you over and over and over again, beating you over the head with it. My Facebook feed has just essentially had Rush interview, Neil Peart trivia, 10 best songs of this decade by Rush. I mean, it's just been nonstop. And I'm such a sucker. I've been clicking on every one of them and, like, legitimately interested in everything I've read. So we're going to do a few different things here over the course of however long this takes us. We're going to go through some songs that were important to us and some sections of songs that were meaningful to us, either things that we think make show Neil's greatness in some way.
Or just something that, you know, struck us as being unique or special or whatever.
Whether it's with his lyrics or with his drumming. We'll maybe talk about a couple memories that we've had, why and how we found ourselves connected to this band and interested in them. And we'll kind of go from there. So never done anything quite like this. This is definitely a unique experience, I think, for both of us. So you want to start with a song, something that that you want to play first?
Sure. I mean, I've been, like I said a minute ago, I've been listening to them all weekend, and I'm not sure why this is, but ever since he passed away, I've kind of been hearing their music a little bit differently, if that makes sense. Like, it actually sounds different. Like, I'm picking up on things that I haven't
heard. The music or the lyrics?
The music.
Okay. So it's not like you're taking new meaning out of the lyrics.
No, and I have to admit, I've never really paid much attention to the lyrics. Like, a complaint that people will always have is that, oh, his lyrics are this or his lyrics are that. And I just sort of look at them blankly, like, I don't know.
Same.
But
unless they're extremely off the wall, like Bytor and the Snow Dog, like, I'm generally like, yeah, I don't really know what that song's about.
Well, here's the thing. When you go on YouTube and you select a song, a lot of the options have the lyrics with them. So if I happen to click on one of those, now I'm looking at the lyrics and I'm thinking, oh, well, maybe there's this whole other aspect of Rush that I've just missed out on. And here I am, 40 years old. All right. I got all the time in the world to invest in that. But yeah, I was going through and I was just kind of, I was trying to think, what are some of the drum parts that I know in my head that are completely unique and no one else would think to do?
Okay.
I'm going to start with this one. This is the end of, all right, you know, I'll play DJ for a second.
Okay.
This is the end of The Big Money from the album Power Windows, 1985. So it kind of repeats like that there. And you hear him, usually when you hear a rock outro. It's just sort of the backbeat of the dun 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 dun. Right. You know, and it goes and then
fades away.
There's a, yeah, there's like a repeating vocal or something like that. That we're gonna get a little technical musically here.
And you need to, because I'm not the musician.
Okay,
I want you to get technical.
I'm gonna.
We're nerding out, Tom.
That's
fine.
The snare drum you hear there, that. I've never really heard anybody put a snare fill in that kind of a phrase there. Where he did it. And then he goes, he kind of, you know, pounds with him mm-hmm. for a second, goes back into it. I mean, it's simple for him, but it makes a heck of a difference in the way that you feel that outro, because it kind of builds you up, boom! And then you're right back with him again. Rush has that effect on their intros and their outros. There's a lot of hitting together with the three musicians, and you really feel that.
Well, because it gives them an opportunity to shine in the margins a little bit, right? I mean, like a lot of bands are so great at, hey, we've created a great hook, right? It's a great guitar riff that everyone's going to remember forever. And obviously, they have some moments like that. But I agree with you. It's some of those surprising beginnings, endings where especially Neil, can show off what he's capable of, because he's already laid down this great beat. And now he can kind of just riff off of it.
But it's
not
rare. I want to make clear, it's not because the other two guys say to themselves, or say to Neil, hey, now's your time to go off for a minute.
No.
Every note that he plays and doesn't play is directly linked with the other two guys and what they're playing or not playing. Think about when you're making music, all you're doing is filling space with air molecules. So it's you're making a judgment on whether I should put a molecule out or out there into the world or not, right? To leave the space there. Neil is making so many judgments every nanosecond in his head. He's just better at that than everybody else.
All right, you want me to play you one here?
Do it.
So since I'll play this one, since you mentioned his snare drum there and just the sound of it. This is a song from Presto, which I like more than most people do. I think you do too. It's funny. I was reading
something which was
talking about Roll the Bones. Like, oh, when they finally, got back to being Rush after the mistake of Presto. And I was like, mistake? I think Presto is one of their top five albums. I love it.
I like Presto.
It's one of their most listenable, I think. I can listen to it over and over again. I'm going to play something a little bit from the past. I love Scars. There's a bunch of songs off that album I really like.
I think relative to the time, people kept, like, if you were a fan of theirs in the 80s or 70s and 80s, people kept waiting for them to get back to rock.
To being,
and
right.
And finally, when there was an album, because Presto does sound much different than the preceding album.
It's a transition. It's a really, I think, good transition from what they were doing to what they did after that with Roll the Bones and Counterparts. But what I am always with that era of Rush, and you can hear it a little bit in the Big Money a minute ago, and I think you hear it especially in Show Don't Tell, which I'm going to play a second of here. The sound of his snare drum is insane. I don't know how many musical songs you and I both know, hundreds of thousands, millions. I don't know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
The crack of his snare drum in this song just always blows me away. Obviously, it's a great beat. I love that song. It's another great live song, and you know, putting the lights on the crowd, and it's a crowd pleaser. It's probably the poppiest song off that album.
But it's the most rockin' song.
True,
too, though.
True, I agree. Yeah. But just how do you tune? I don't know enough about. I played a little drums when I was a kid, mostly just because of Neil. We can talk about that later, but. How do you get that sound? Is that just the engineering of it, or I mean,
it's a couple of things. It's first of all, it's the tuning of the drum, how tight you have it tuned. Two, the way the drum is mic'd in the studio. Three, the space that it's in. Is it in a big room? Mm. Like, did they record it in a church, or did they do it in a small studio like we're in right now? Plus, by this point, they're, 15 years into their album-making career? They've already made a bunch of albums. Neil probably has in his head the specifics of how he wants his drums to sound anyway.
Yeah. And that's not something you hear a lot about, right? I mean, when you think about Neil and, you know, when you think every time anyone mentions Rush, they mention, you know, people playing air drums to Tom Sawyer and his fills and his solos. And we're going to do some of that as well. But one of the first things that I just think, the sound of his drums. I know he's got like 9 million of them back there and he can turn all the way around. But the amount of precision that goes into creating that snare sound, I just think is emblematic of what Neil meant.
You know what? I think when you're, I'm not saying they never wanted a hit song, but when your priority isn't to write like a top 10 single, and your record label, you have the support of your record label to make something other than that, you can really take a lot of care with those types of elements of the music. Alex can do it with his guitar. Geddy can do it with his bass, his keys, and his vocals. And there's only three of them. There's not four. There's a huge, huge difference in the amount of patience that band members have with each other between a three-piece band and a four. And given that they had survived all that time already, I'm sure they just left it to Neil. And they said, hey, figure out what you want to do, what's working for you. And then they come together and say, okay, what works for the song? All right, I'll go with one here. Let's see. All right, this is off my favorite album. This is off Signals from 1982. This is kind of a regular-sounding backbeat behind what's going on melodically. But if you listen to some of the fills, some of the, I guess, the snare and the hi-hat fills, it sort of advanced the music and just prop it up a little bit. You'll know why I picked it.
So glad you picked this too.
That's, you know what, when I was,
I'm glad you picked
it,
this as a drum song, because I think when I think of Analog Kid, I always think of the guitar riff in it, because it's a little bit of a, it's a riff you remember, right?
Yeah, it's the guitar and the bass together going. Yeah,
so it's catchier than a lot of other Rush tunes. But I'm glad you picked it for its drum.
Yeah, I mean, for that riff to work, you have to have the beat driving behind it, but you have to have perfect tempo, and you know, just the way he'll fill in, like, the space that the bass and guitar leave when that riff ends and he kind of jumps in there. I mean, that is perfect trio music that you're hearing right there.
Does the snare beat to that almost lag a little bit? It almost seems to lag behind the music, and I know it never catches up, and I know it's right on time, but it's interesting to me. It just sort of the sound I get out of it is that the drum sort of lags.
I'll say something about that. You know that a track is being recorded live when you hear the drums or all the music together, maybe just a little bit behind the beat. Mm. That's called swing. You're swinging when you do that. Okay. And you know that the music hasn't been quantized to a click track like you would with basically any pop artist now. This is these three guys. I'm not saying there are no overdubs, but they're likely just playing live together and getting the best take there. But this song, you know, I really like synthesizers a lot when they're used right. I feel like these guys did that, maybe overused them at times. But melodically, at this point in their career, they're such better songwriters and just musicians. I don't mean players. They're that too. But they're just better musicians. Mm. The interplay between everybody is so much more advanced. Like at that point in music, nobody could really touch them for that. And I think this song is just, it represents that well.
It's cool. All right, I got, I'm going to play two in a row quickly because I think they go together.
Okay.
Where was I reading? I don't know. I don't pretend to be an expert. I'm certainly not a musical expert like you are. And I didn't obsessively read about the band throughout my life. But I was recently either, I think I was reading something about how Neil really looked up to Keith Moon as a drummer. That was some of his way of getting into the drums, was to be as much like Keith Moon as possible. And when I think of Keith Moon, I don't exactly think disciplined. I think, how many drums can I hit in as short a time as possible?
As undisciplined as a rock drummer has ever been.
He's a wild man, right? I mean, both on and off the drum kit. That's what he is. When I think Keith Moon, I think wild man. Oh my God, he's so fast and he can hit all these drums, and he's just a wall of immense sound. And that to me is the defining Keith Moon characteristic. What I always find so interesting about Neil is that he's got that. He can hit as many drums as anybody, and that's what makes the fills and Tom Sawyer so famous, and that's what makes his solo so incredible. But he always brings, I'm going to call it, a precision and a sense of mathematics that I'm not sure Keith Moon, that I would put onto Keith Moon. That's not to say he couldn't have done it, but I don't think it's what he's known for. So I got one here to talk, that shows the precision and one that has some of the mathematics. I'll start with the precision, and you and I have talked about this section before. It's from Livia Stronciato, and it's one of the, I think this is a Lurkston Wonderland section, because you gotta have cool names.
I've never been able to break up the subsections of any of their tunes. I don't know where they, like 2112 I can.
Yeah.
But I don't know where they start and end.
The only reason I know is that at some point when I was in early high school, like ninth grade, somebody gave me a ton of Rush sheet music for the drums. Mm. It was not guitar tabs or any of that. It had the lyrics and it had the drum, was it tablature? Is that what it's called? Where you can see like the snare at the top and then the fills and the bass at the bottom. It was amazing. And so I would sit at home in my bedroom listening to the stereo, cranked up, of course, and I'd hold this sheet music in front of me and just listen and watch the drum part. And I'm not like a well-trained musician, but I would see where in Tom Sawyer, at least according to this, he went into 13/4 time. We'll get to Free Will here in a minute because of the crazy time signatures at the beginning of that. I know time signature is a big part of Rush, right. But yeah, just that was the only way I ever saw some of those sections of songs. And Livia Stronciato was one of the ones I had. And no matter how many times I read it, no matter how many times I've heard this song, and I've even asked you about it, I can't mathematically predict what he's doing here.
You can't count it, you mean? Oh.
All right, a couple things. First of all, that's the live version. I decided to throw the live version on here from Exit Stage Left.
Yeah.
Because as much as I'm impressed with his precision, the fact that that's live just blows me away.
I know. I was surprised you actually went with the live version. And when I heard that, his touch on the hi-hat is almost like the way they engineered it in the studio. I'm sure they got it just right. But live, it sounds like it's just right also.
Isn't that amazing?
By the way, that whole section's in 7.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is obviously complicated to our brain, which is not used to hearing anything in 7.
Right. You have to really count it to realize that's what
it is.
There's
other things they do in 7 that I think make more sense. That one, I don't know. Every time I hear it, I've never fully been able to just comprehend and think about what he's doing with each of his four limbs, how he's able to keep that little hi-hat going in its way while everything else is doing something different. It just seems to require such a completely different brain power than I have.
Exactly.
And then just to finish off, what he ends up, you know, the way this goes back into the rest of the song is just so cool. It's a great solo too. So as it turns out, Alex is a pretty good guitarist, too. We could do a full tribute to Alex some other day and just
talk about how
ridiculous he is as a guitarist. And to do all that live, I don't know, the precision blows me away. Similar to that, Tom, hold on, let me see if I can pull this up. It's not a great song. It's just how great is
Livia Stronciato? I was thinking to myself when I was putting these songs in our system today, I like their 80s stuff more just in general, but that's the song that shows what they can do the best.
Mm-hmm.
That song showcases each one of them the best.
I don't know if it's my favorite Rush song, but in some ways I think it's the best Rush song, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And because there's no lyrics in it, for anybody that sees Geddy Lee's voice as a barrier to entry, you don't get to use that as an excuse.
Not for this one.
Like, sorry, Geddy's not singing on this one. Yes, it's a 9-minute song. That the audience, and by the way, go back and listen to the beginning of that song on Exit Stage Left when he says he's going to do Livia Stronciato. And I think that's the last song, if I'm not mistaken.
Maybe the encore,
And just how excited the audience is to hear a 9.5 minute esoteric instrumental, they're out of their mind excited. I love that element.
What is that? What does that tell you?
What does it tell you?
It tells me that there's something that, objectively speaking, is just a little bit more special about this band than your average, you know, whatever pop act,
right,
that people just sort of consume and then throw out the window.
So you like jam bands in addition to that. I don't. I'm not a jam band guy. I know you've traveled and seen Fish and this and that. I'm not like that. What I've been doing however many concerts and seen a lot of, not necessarily pop bands, but more pop rock bands and metal bands.
Even like a band like Van Halen,
sure,
or something.
Guns N' Roses, yeah, or Poison or Motley Crue, whatever. Everyone's most excited to hear the hits.
Yeah.
I don't know that I can say that with Rush. I mean, yes, there are obviously, when Tom Sawyer or a few other songs get played, there is an extra sense of excitement. But you and I went and saw R40, the last show together?
Yeah, 2015.
Other than the brand new stuff, which not everybody seemed to know yet, was there anything that didn't get people and they're playing Jacob's Ladder and Xanadu. And
Between the Wheels.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
People are excited. Just, oh my God, I know this song because I listen to every album so deeply.
I think it's because when it's a band like Rush or Fish that has that kind of connection with its audience, you're doing so much work.
Mm-hmm.
You're putting in, you're investing yourself. It's active listening on the part of the audience.
Yes.
And
you
so
don't just put it on the background while you're doing homework.
No, I mean, you can after a while because you know the songs well. But when you actually get to go to the local arena,
yeah,
and see a song perform that you don't think you're going to see, it's like, whoa.
Right.
Like, I know this song because I was listening to Grace Under Pressure, like, on repeat all last week. But no, and you wouldn't normally do that if you were just a fan who liked the hits, because they don't really have hits.
And I'm going to change the format of this. Rather than doing some memories at the end, I want to intersperse a few. When you're my age, you and I are about the same age. I'm 41, you're 40, right? So what method did you consume? What was it, tape? Was it record? Was it CD? What did most of your early Rush listening consist of?
It's a great question, and the time that it happened is key. It was like fall 91,
yeah,
was
same.
When Roll the Bones got released.
Yeah,
that was right around the time my parents bought their first CD player.
Okay,
but that said, my friend Dan, who was the one that got me into Rush, he burned me a copy of Roll the Bones onto tape.
Huh.
So I took a tape back home. That was the format that I listened to. What about you?
Tapes. All used.
All tapes.
All used tapes.
Okay.
I only bought a handful of new Rush tapes. I listened entirely on tape. I didn't have a CD player. I liked tapes. I didn't feel like spending the money on new CDs. So they were all used. So I would walk to, mostly in Harvard Square at the time, but there were a few other places in and around Boston on Newbury Street where you could go find, you know, they were used tape stores. And I would go in, and every time I just go to the Rush section,
you get a new one,
and look to see what they had. And I just, oh, I don't have this one yet. I'll get Signals. I don't have this one yet. I'll get, you know, whatever. Hold Your Fire. And some of them I liked more than others, and some of them took more time, and some of them were better quality than others. But
right.
I for me, it was entirely used tapes that I went through. And for a while, it was just Chronicles, just listening to Chronicles over and over again to truly get a sense of this band.
I think that
that was really the thing that got me there.
I think the format that you listen to, it makes a difference. So whether it's
sure.
vinyl, CD, or tape, because in the case of the tape,
you have to listen to it all.
You have to listen, and you have to go in, and you have to flip it once side one
so
is over.
Active listening. I like tapes. Tapes are still like my favorite. I get all the problems with them. Records have that purity, right, and the crackle. CDs are a cleaner sound. I like that tapes were sort of a pain in the butt. Like they weren't perfect. You had to listen to each song. Fast forwarding was a pain. It didn't work very well. Like,
but
there
was
always
an
issue.
The thing you could do with it the best is bring it in the car.
Yes, it was very handy.
Because it wasn't until later that a
right.
CD player in a car was like
and
a given.
You could put it in a Walkman, which you couldn't do with a
right.
CD or a record. So you could walk around and listen. There were a lot of things about tapes
yeah.
that I liked. All right, since we were talking about sort of the mathematical portion of Rush. I mean, this is the beginning of Free Will, which is one of those sections that has crazy time signature, right? It's like 6/8, 7/8, 8/8, or whatever it is. You can tell me what it is probably better. But
I think the beginning's in 4.
Oh, hold on. After this. We'll be right back.
Okay, so that starts in 4.
Right, the very beginning.
Then it goes, it alternates between 6 and 7.
Okay. Well, that's not normal.
No.
You're not supposed to do that.
No, you're not.
There's no other song that I know of, and I know there's some Dream Theater fan or Tool fan right now. I was like, oh, you don't know about this. Like, okay, I'm not as big a fan. Sorry. I don't know of any other song that gets radio play like this one, because you hear Free Will on the radio all the time. In fact, I heard it in the limo going to my junior prom, and I was like, oh, can we listen to this? And right as Katie comes, each of us! Like, oh, people are in the limo are looking at me like,
what is this? What are we listening
to? Why are you listening to anybody with this voice? It's terrible. This is a song you hear on the radio all the time. It starts off, would you just say? It starts in four,
and then it goes to, it alternates, because six, eight, then seven, eight.
Tom. Music's not supposed to do that.
I know, but the clever bands do this. Genesis did it. Rush did it. I mean, the bands that had sophisticated musicians and sophisticated music were willing to take chances where you could almost disguise it.
All right. So how do you get yourself to think that way?
You have to say to yourself, okay.
Because I can't.
It could go.
I can't
it could go
get
one
myself. I can get myself into a mode of, I mean, 4-4 is a norm. I play the little drums. I understand do a rock beat. I understand 4-4. I kind of understand 6-8, and that's something people do. I understand 3-4. There's a part of me that can understand 7-4, even though it's hard. Can you please explain how you change time signatures back and forth, and it makes sense in your brain, not just to play, but to write?
Here's how. In the case of that, and again, you're asking me to speculate on what they may have been thinking. When they're writing that riff, they're just adding one beat. So they're taking the same riff and adding one beat to the end of it because they just felt like it. Honestly, like, I mean, it either comes to you and you just play it and later you figure out that it was in a weird time signature, or you say, hey, Getty, wouldn't it be cool if we just, I know you've got your riff in 6, but why don't we make it 7, alternating back and forth, and I can do an extra snare hit. Let's try it. And then they run it a couple of times.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, before you know it, you've got 3 different time signatures.
And yet somehow you've created a classic rock staple
in
Free Will that everybody knows. And when you hear that riff, you know exactly what it is because you hear it on the radio.
And here's the other thing. Well,
bizarre.
Here's, okay, that speaks to their ability to groove, okay, even in a 6 or 7 feel. You're still just doing, like, back and forth with your head, right?
Mm-hmm.
If music can make you do that, it's in the groove. Mm. If it's making you just sort of, like shudder back and forth and you don't know where you are.
It doesn't make you epileptic.
Right, like, Dream Theater does that.
Mm-hmm.
Rush does it at times. Other prog bands do that. It's just an exercise in seeing what they could do. Rush stays in the groove most of the time. My turn?
Yeah.
All right.
What do you want to play?
Boom. Let's go with a little bit of, oh, Digital Man. I love this. Is also from Signals 1982. I'm not even sure really what to call this beat. I'll try and think about it while we're listening to it. Here it comes.
The analog kid grow up to be the digital man or the new world man?
I think both.
Really?
I think.
Amazing.
Well, because the songs are out of order, because you'd think he would become the new world man before he became the digital man. But that comes first on the album, so that's kind of confusing. That beat right there, what the hi-hat is doing, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, against 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. That is hard to play. But when you're a kid, you have to learn how to do that. Think of the song Everybody Wants to Rule the World by Tears for Fears.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's that same beat, except slower. I'm pretty sure it's that same. I'm not saying that Neil invented it. I mean, it may have come before that. But to be able, you were talking before how to organize all your limbs, to be playing syncopated beat on the hi-hat, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, against boom, bat, doom,
tat, doom, right,
on in the snare and the bass. Actually, the bass is the thing that's going back and forth. It's just incredible. And yet, It stays in the groove. It lays the groundwork for Getty to go off and do whatever he's
doing. There's a lot of songs where I don't think you realize how complex the drum track is until you see him. Until you see him play it. So yeah. I was watching, this is another one of these things I've seen on YouTube over the last couple of days and weeks, was him playing, we were talking about today, playing Heresy.
Yeah.
I always hate that word.
My friend Dan, who got me that album, used to call it Hearsay also.
I know, and it's not Hearsay.
I'm like, it's Heresy.
It's Heresy, I know. But it's Neil playing Heresy, which is not, it's never been one of my favorite songs. It's a good song. Yeah. It's not one of my favorites. And I remember at the time, I was a kid, I was 13 maybe when that album came out. I remember thinking that Neil wasn't the same as he once was because he wasn't going crazy on the drums. He wasn't playing things like La Via Strangiato. He wasn't YYZ. It wasn't Tom Sawyer, the Crazy Phils. And it's like, oh, he's just sort of turned into a normal drummer. This is 13-year-old me. And you watch it later and you watch what he's doing because this video actually showed him playing that song. It's like, oh, no. No, that's not it at all.
Yeah.
What he's doing is insane. It just doesn't always sound that way because he's so subtle and such a master of his craft. What an incredible musician
he is. Wait a minute. So you would listen to them enough by 91 to know?
Yeah, I listened because I think the first thing I bought was Chronicles. Maybe it was 92. Okay,
which is like their greatest hit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like two songs off each album. And so that was really what I had listened to that year a ton. And then Roll the Bones came out like that year. It was right when I gotten into them. So for me, new Rush starts at Roll the Bones.
Okay.
Everything before Roll the Bones is old Rush.
Okay, because for me, new Rush starts at Roll the Bones also, but I didn't have any frame of reference.
I had a little frame of reference.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I had heard, I remember hearing Show Don't Tell on the radio and Tom Sawyer and Limelight and a couple of those other tracks. So I did have something, but when Roll the Bones came out, that was new Rush.
Okay.
To me, it was the first new album that I'd ever bought. So,
you know what? That's another interesting thing about them. Just rock music of that generation, late 70s, 80s, to think that their middle period happened when we were in middle school is a strange thing, because most bands from that era were getting back together for reunion tours when we were in the 90s, when we were teenagers, and yet they stayed together and that music still sounded new.
Yeah. It's remarkable.
I could treat it as a new album, not just some throwaway that, you know, they were getting back together.
But all bands, I think, have some of that element for people of everything sort of starts and ends where you discovered them, like the difference between new and old. So Metallica's like that for me, too. Like, I discovered Metallica. I was not into heavy metal until I was. I discovered Metallica after they had released Master of Puppets. So the Black Album, to me, is the beginning of new Metallica. That's just how it is. That is a defining difference. Everything before it is cool. Everything after it is not.
Don't you think most people would say that, though?
I don't know. I think you and I do because we're the same age. But I think there's plenty of people who consider the Black Album much more like Master of Puppets and
like the beginning of Metallica?
Yeah, I guess I should say it wasn't even after Master of Puppets. It was after Injustice for All. I consider Injustice for All the last old Metallica album. I think there are probably people who consider that to be the first new one. I don't know.
I look at the Black Album like moving pictures. It's what they're going to be remembered
for.
True.
Well, that's for sure.
And it's, you know, enough. There's enough stylistic change there.
I wish that wasn't the case. I wish they were being remembered for Master Puppets instead.
Well, yeah.
That to me that's their moving picture. Well, we were talking about today because I think Ride the Lightning is Permanent Waves.
See,
it leads you to this masterpiece.
Okay. See, I would say our Master of Puppets is like their 2112.
Oh, wow.
Best of their classic period.
That's a good way to look at it, too. That's a good comparison. Why don't you give me another one? Because I've got a few others I want to get to.
All right, I only have one more.
I have like five more.
I have two more. I bet you didn't think I was going to pick this one. You know what? I'm going to tell you why I picked this one before I play it. First show I saw, April 24th, 1994.
And we have determined, by the way, that my wife was at the same show.
Oh, she was there. Okay,
she was at the Hartford Civic Center just when you are. I don't know that you saw each other.
I'm sure we did.
Heather was there. She'd seen Rush once with me, and she had seen them once in 1994 with you. It's amazing.
When I was, I was 15. All right, so April 24th, 94, Hartford Civic Center, Counterparts Tour. I'm sitting in the back of the hockey arena, almost along the boards on Getty's side. Okay, middle of the set, maybe middle end of the set. Sometimes you get that moment in a concert where it doesn't really matter what song they're doing, but you feel like, okay, it's that moment where I'm connected completely with
the band. I know exactly what song you're going to play. I'm not even looking at the list. I know what song you're going to play. I have a sense.
Okay, here it
comes. Do you want me to guess? You're going to play it. Oh, not what I thought.
I'm not sure what the reason is.
Mystic
that song's
Rhythms.
Called Mystic Rhythms. It's also off Power Windows 1985. I just had a moment where I looked up and I saw whatever like their lighting pattern was or something. I just had this moment where it was. I went from really liking this band to like not just
connecting,
loving,
immersing,
whatever
yourself.
The word is, like they became something more to me.
It becomes
in that
an immersive
moment.
Experience.
Yeah,
it's funny. I thought you were going to play something else. Maybe you'll get to it. I thought you were going to play "Leave That Thing Alone," which is off that Counterparts album.
And
right?
They played that at that show.
Yeah, and that song I think has some of that same immersive quality, especially if you saw it outside with the lasers and all that. It just it felt right, and the way the guitars in that song kind of pierce through the mm-hmm. I don't know, I was, that song does that for me a little bit. But when you played Mystic Rhythms, it reminded me of a story that I shouldn't tell.
Uh-oh.
I'm embarrassed. Can I admit something embarrassing?
You better. That's what this is for.
I must have been like 16 or so. I was asked to write a poem. It wasn't for school, so I didn't cheat in school, but I was asked to write some sort of a poem for something. And I essentially ripped off Mystic
Rhythms. You plagiarized Mystic
Rhythms? Yes, I did. Just a little bit, like a line or two. But I think I took that beginning of, what is it, so many things I think about when I look far away.
Yes. You're the Houston Astros.
I'm awful. I'm so embarrassed that I did this. I was young. I needed the money. I don't know what to tell you. I did, yeah. And I've always sort of been embarrassed about that. And I shouldn't admit it. But I did. Neil, I'm sorry.
Okay.
But thank you. I was 16. I needed to impress a girl, and it helped. So thank you.
Oh, that's what it was for.
Yeah.
You know what? That's okay.
It wasn't like for credit.
No, that's fine.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
I didn't credit him, though. And I should have.
No, that's
sorry.
Okay.
Well, I admit it.
High school, junior high?
High school. Was that too late?
No, it's okay, fine. Yeah. Hey, can I, quick story?
There was a good reason.
Quick story about poetry and Neil. Sophomore year of high school, we had to bring in a poem to read to the class,
mm-hmm.
and my teacher told us we could use music lyrics. So I pulled out the liner notes from Hemispheres, and I'm looking through it, and I'm like, all right, I'll read the trees. And I sat down in front of the class to read it, and I start reading it.
Oh, no.
And as I'm doing it, I'm like, I hate these lyrics. Like, I'm so embarrassed.
Oh, no.
Like, I'm reading these lyrics, and I got through it, and I sat down, and I was like, oh God.
Where
like your whole body gets hot
because
you're so embarrassed.
Yes.
And, and to tell you the truth, I'm not sure if I put that song on since. Even though I like
it's
that.
It's actually one of my least favorite Rush songs.
See, I like the music more than you.
Mm.
But
not one of my favorites. Okay, I mean, that doesn't mean, I still love, it's
right.
a great song,
a
but
good,
if you're asking me to compare, especially, you know, that one's on Chronicles, that's considered one of their, you know, sort of
hits
off that. It's never been one of my favorites. Hmm. You kind of make fun of some of Neil's lyrics, which I think is totally fair.
Only those.
At them. I got a couple songs here that I like. I love his lyrics too. I came up with three just because they're all sort of different. But we mentioned Presto, how much I like Presto before. There's a song off Presto where his lyrics are probably a little bit. You know, I'm not as big into the Bytor 2112
fantasy
type lyrics. I am interested, though, in what he ended up writing about a little bit later in their career. I'm going to play Red Sector A in a little bit because I think that's such a unique idea. But The Pass is, you know, I think really meaning, you know, this idea of writing about suicide. And when you're a young kid and 13, 14, not that I was ever suicidal per se, but, you know, being in middle school and early high school stinks for, you know, almost everybody, and certainly for people who are listening to Rush.
That's why, I mean,
part.
Who else listens to Rush?
Right.
Depressed junior high
kids. Yeah, so it's, and it's easy to play, obviously, Subdivisions, which probably says that the best.
Yeah.
But we're assuming if you're listening to this, you already know about the lyrics to Subdivision. So we'll do something else. This is some of Neil writing in The Pass.
Everybody's at home. Nature in the sea, all right.
I could go on. I love this. This is one of my favorite Rush songs. I love The Past. They played it live like the last couple of concerts. They kind of went back to it and played it a few times.
Yeah, I remember that.
I love it. It's just there's something about that song I've always appreciated. It sounds a little different from a lot of their other stuff.
Yeah, well, lyrically, each line is personal. It's very connected, and because the idea is said in a concise way. It's easy to understand. You don't have to do a ton of work to figure out.
No.
If you had the lyrics in front of you, anyway.
Yeah.
I actually had to read through them to get what he was saying. One thing I want to say about Rush music, too, no matter what era we're talking about, usually when you write a rock song, pop song, you have your intro, A section, B section, C is the bridge, mm-hmm. and then you have your outro and you're done. They have a lot of sections.
No kidding.
Like, I'm not just talking in 2112. Even in a song like this, we heard, I think, four different, like, distinct sections there that they went through.
That's a short clip.
Right. And one building to the next, and then I think it ends with, don't slam the door on me, where it's just the vocals.
Yep.
And then it softly goes back to the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So it basically just runs four sections over and over, and it kind of builds it each time. But that's really unique. That they can cram so much into, what, a five-minute song?
Yeah. Red Sector, I assume Neil wrote this. Actually, as we're talking now, I'm wondering whether or not he actually wrote the lyrics, because I know that it's Getty's family who had...
They've been in Auschwitz.
Right, had escaped Nazi Germany. So I guess I'm realizing I don't know whether or not Neil wrote this. I assumed he wrote it about thinking about Getty's family, and I don't know that, so I guess that's just sort of my assumption that that's what it is. But Red Sector A, whether it's Neil writing or Rush writing, I don't know, but I can look it up here while we're talking, I guess. The idea of writing a song about that is pretty remarkable, and...
Yeah, can I say something real quick about that? The live clip of that song, I love watching, and I've often thought while I'm listening to it...
To Red Sector A?
Yeah. I would really like to show this song, this clip, to somebody. But then I think, man, if they start listening to these lyrics, they're going to get depressed. Like, I'm not sure if I want to share this with anybody.
Yes.
Like, it's that personal.
And there's a little barricade to entry, right? A barrier to entry. It's not easy. You have to want it.
Yeah, the only thing that is inviting about it, I think, is its drum beat, because it's so straightforward. It's like almost like a disco,
mm-hmm.
you know, like that four on the floor thing he's got going.
All right, well, here is a little of Red Sector A. Sickness to insanity. Prayer to profanity. Days and weeks and months go by. Don't feel the hunger too weak to cry. I hear the sound of gunfire at the prison gate. Are the liberators here? So haunting. Are we the last ones left alive?
Are we the only human beings to survive?
I mean, remember the first time hearing that song and not listening to it that carefully, but just hearing that that chorus. Are we the last ones left alive? Are we the only human beings to survive? And thinking it was much more of a sci-fi song.
Yeah.
And then,
like, it's about dystopian.
Yeah, some dystopian future. And then going back. Look, my family's Jewish, and I learned a lot about the Holocaust growing up and going to Hebrew school. I was bar mitzvahed, etc. And, you know, when I then, like, paid more attention, was he really talking about, oh, man, no, that's not a dystopian future. That's a dystopian past. And as it turns out, not really that long ago when these songs were being written, right? I mean, you're talking 40 years earlier.
Yeah.
I mean, so you and I are 40. I mean, I know when we were kids, World War II seemed like a gazillion years ago.
It was like the 80s.
It's crazy.
Now.
Right? I mean, like, it wasn't really, it was still somewhat fresh.
Right.
Enough so that, you know, Getty's parents escaped being in Auschwitz. So, or survived, at least, being in Auschwitz. So I don't know. That always impressed me, that they were able to capture the essence of the Holocaust. Who does that?
Okay, again.
In a popular rock song.
Again, I keep coming back to this idea that they're better musicians, better songwriters in the 80s. Part of being a good songwriter is being able to take your lyrics and really match the tone that you're going for with the lyrics with the music.
Well, that does.
It's a very haunting, like the drums are just beating along, yep. right? Like, as if you're sitting there in this environment with that just beating in your head, and it's the lyrics, right? The way he sings them. Are we the last? It's almost like it's a bad dream.
Yes. It's absolutely like that.
It's like, hey, we need to write a song that sounds like a bad dream because that's what the lyrics are about.
Yeah, and then, of course, because it's Neil, not only do you get that beat, but then you got him just almost playing around with the offbeat, with the ride.
Which is standard Neil,
right.
The spirit of the radio. Yeah, you find that a lot in his playing, where he hits the bell on the offbeat.
And he's just kind of playing with it and almost doodling. And, again, this sort of goes back to what he was saying in that heresy clip of once he's mastered a beat, then he can start to experiment in and around the edges of it. And that song, actually, I didn't pick it for that reason, but I think you kind of hear that. You want one other lyric song that I happen
sure.
to like? This is a kind of a deep track, although they played it when we saw them together.
We argued the other day a little when we talked.
Would you consider Middletown Dreams a deep track?
Yes, I would.
I would too.
Definitely.
I love it. That might be my favorite song off that album.
The hits on that album are Big Money, Mystic Rhythms,
New World Man.
Oh, that's no, we're talking Power Windows.
Sorry, that's. Yeah,
I think it might only be those two.
Big Money, yeah, that's probably right. But I love Middletown Dreams. I love Territories also.
And Territories is great.
They're two really good songs. But I always really like the lyrics in Middletown Dreams, and it's sort of this idea of being
needing to escape. From
yeah,
where you are.
And I think again, when you're a teenager, that idea of like wherever I live, I didn't live in the middle of nowhere. I lived in just outside of Boston, but wherever I am, I want to get out. I want to be somewhere else. I'm sick of my friends. I'm sick of being trapped. I'm sick of not being able to go wherever I want to go. I'm sick of rules. That's what kind of is to be a teenager, especially once you're 15, 16, you're just about to get your license. You just want freedom.
Right.
All you want is to be free. And he's not necessarily talking about kids in this one.
Yeah.
He's talking, I think, more about adults who are looking to, you know, they have these dreams to go somewhere else. But it still speaks to, I think, a lot of that teen angst of, God, I just want to get out of here. I just want to experience what else is out there. I left in a little bit at the end just because the bass line is awesome.
With the way the bass line matched up with the drum fill.
That's awesome.
Okay, something I have to say there. When we're talking about these songs that are a little more emotional based, I guess we'll say, I can really see why now they felt the need to use as many synthesizers as they did. To me, the pad synths in the background there, it really adds to the emotion of the song.
Almost like a score of a movie.
You kind of.
Like in the big scene, emotional scene, you get the right sounds.
You might use an orchestra in a movie. This kind of substitutes. But if you just had drums, bass, and guitar and vocals here, it would not have the same effect. It would feel a little bit empty. Now, granted, this is the mid-80s. At the zenith of synthesizer technology. And this is a band that charges ahead and tries to use they'll use whatever they can get their hands on.
Or whatever's new. I mean,
right.
let's sample.
And that's what on this album in particular, they started using things like sequencers, and you hear a lot of that there. But there's still a reason to do it. They're not doing it just to use those things. They're doing it because it actually helps the music.
Well, I'd agree with all that. It's a fantastic point. But I just when I hear that song, I just imagine telephone wires, and I imagine being in the Midwest somewhere, looking up at the telephone wires and thinking, where do those go?
Yeah.
What happens if I just follow them? Right? My dream that they transport the wires you need to get out of town. Like, can I just follow that and see where it goes and get me to California, get me to New York, get me to the Chicago? I don't know. I always imagine that just really speaking to somebody in that spot.
Just picture a kid whether it's a CD liner notes or a record or whatever, reading those lyrics alone in his or her bedroom while you're listening to this stuff over and over and over. That's the special experience that you get with this band. And that I wish, whether it's this band or another band, I just wish everybody could have that.
Yeah.
Because it's really, it's important.
You want to play? You have what else? You have?
Leave that thing alone.
Oh,
here?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll give it. All right. So this is a, this is where I thought they got
Counterparts
back to rock.
Counterparts are a really good album.
It's a heavy album. It's a rocking album. This is an instrumental track.
Animate is such a good song. Stick It Out is such a good song off that. There's some really good songs on
that album. Yeah, the album opener, like the 1-2 whole combination, definitely an effector. But this comes later in the album. Leave That Thing Alone, which I believe is the to Where's My Thing or some trilogy or something.
But there's no actual trilogy. They
it's only
playing around.
No, it's loosely connected in some way. Anyway, here it is.
A great live
song. Right there.
It's such a good live song.
We went from like tribal drumming to like an early 90s funk to jazz back to a mixture of tribal drumming and jazz. Meanwhile, you've got whatever's going on with the bass and guitar. I mean,
it's really remarkable.
It's okay, so that's 1993. This band started in 74 recording albums. There aren't that many bands that are breaking new ground 19 years into their career and who are also, in a sense, keeping up with the times. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a very 1993 album that you might hear from another newer band.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I'll keep talking about the live element of that song because I remember seeing it live and I saw them. I think I saw them twice in the Counterparts tour, once indoors, once outside. So I saw them at the first two times I saw them were both at Worcester Centrum.
Yeah, yeah, I've been
and
there.
And then the third time I saw them was at Great Woods, which is now called something else. It was an outdoor amphitheater, not dissimilar to White River here.
It's just the outdoor shed thing.
Right, it was easier to get to, but it was the same idea, that outdoor amphitheater thing. And you know, they do a great light show and the lasers and all that. And that song just lent itself to it perfectly, I thought. Because you're outside, warm summer night, it's dark. Alex's guitars just kind of slice through the night when you hear them. And the green lasers and the smoke. That song is I've always loved it for that reason.
That's interesting.
It evokes that memory instantly to me of being outside.
The similar memory to the one that I had before. I never saw him outside. I only saw him in arenas.
Oh, I saw him a couple times outside. I actually think they were better outdoors.
Really?
Yeah, and that might surprise. I never saw them in like a football stadium or anything.
No, I don't think they ever played one.
And I didn't see them at the Gorge, which I probably should have. I regret that I didn't go out to see them at the Gorge. That probably would have been awesome. But I think they were better outside. I thought that especially Alex's guitar sound lent itself to being outside at night.
That's interesting.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah, because the way that those amphitheaters are shaped, yeah, sure, I could see maybe, I can't explain the physics of it.
Yeah.
I don't know how that works.
The sonic quality?
I've always enjoyed the indoor shows better because of the lights, because I think no matter where you're positioned in the building, you get a pretty good feel for the lights, whereas if you're in one of those outdoor sheds, you have to be in a certain spot.
So this guy Dan got you into Rush?
Yeah, Dan Kozloff.
What was that like? How did that happen?
Okay. Me, him, and John, a trio of our own, we were kind of those kids.
You're a bit of a power trio.
Right. We were in junior high. We would be the type of kids that listened to Rush, except the three of us didn't yet. I was into the Police, another trio. He was into Rush. So we just started swapping music. Mm-hmm. He lived down the street from me. And then once we started liking each other's music, we decided, okay, let's start a trio of our own. Okay, who's going to play what? He wanted to be Geddy.
Right.
I wanted to be Andy from the Police. So he's playing bass and singing. I'm playing guitar. John already plays drums. Now we've got our own little trio.
There you go.
And what are we playing? We're playing the Police. We're playing Rush.
Easy place to start.
Well, okay. I almost quit guitar.
Of course.
Because these in Queen too, I couldn't, this stuff was too hard to play.
Yeah.
down the line a little bit,
How was the drummer doing with all that?
Oh, he could.
Stuart Copeland's not easy either.
No,
I mean,
but
he could pull off
a believable tempo.
That's impressive.
Yeah. Well, long story short, later on, I picked up a bass. That changed my life because for a million reasons. But yeah, that's how it started.
I was I went to camp, various different camps, sleepover camp when I was a kid. I used to go for like 8 weeks at a time and then 4 weeks at a time. And while I was there, I had started listening to a little bit of rock. I really wanted to learn to play the drums, but I had this counselor there who was a drummer. And he actually he taught me how to play drums. I mean, not well, but he gave me the basics of how to play a rock beat and jazz beat, some stuff like that. And this is after I had hurt my hand, too. So trying to learn how to play the drums with a bad hand was obviously a challenge. But he was awesome and really did a great job of kind of working through it with me and helping me figure out how to do it. And he really got me into three bands. He got me much deeper into Rush. He got me into Queensryche, which I think you can see a bit of a connection. And he got me into King's X, which I think is like the most underrated band of their era. And not like I'd heard It's Love, but he got me into old King's X, like Gretchen Goes to Nebraska. If you're a Rush fan or just if you're a music fan and you're still listening to this for some unknown reason, you've been listening for the last hour and a half, go pick up Gretchen. Go, you don't have to pick it up. Go listen to Gretchen Goes to Nebraska by King's X. It's such a cool album full of just great harmony. But behind it is some really great music. So anyway, he taught me how to play drums and got me into Neil and got me into Rush. His name was Dave. I don't even remember his last name.
Would you say he Sherpa'd you?
A little bit,
because
yes.
A lot of Fish fans talk about their experience in those camps where somebody
in the Northeast.
Some older kid would Sherpa them towards.
There is a little bit of that.
Yeah.
And he got me, and I just became completely obsessed with it. I was listening to it all the time. And so I did, my first show was on the Roll the Bones tour. And I was, you know, I got into it for the drums, first and foremost, more than anything. I loved the drum. My dad had played the drums as a kid in a band called The Misunderstood, right? You know, playing Paul Revere and the Raiders and that kind of stuff. And so I was there, and all I wanted to do was see Neil solo. I'd heard that it was great. It's not like with the internet now you could sort of see all that. So I didn't know what to expect other than that I knew Neil was going to solo. And when I heard, and this is still my favorite of Neil's solo efforts, the various versions of
the
Rhythm Method, I love the one from that tour. I could skip ahead in this for a moment, but that was the part that I'll always remember.
Why?
I just thought it was so fast, the echo effect of him hitting these two dung-dung, ding-ding, and it like kind of echoed throughout the
Had you been to many rock concerts before?
Maybe a few, but not a ton.
Because the experience as a kid of going into a major arena show can be overwhelming in and of itself.
Yeah, that's probably true. When I was 13,
right?
My parents drove me and a friend out to Worcester. They were going to pick us up at the end of the night. We had to like arrange a meeting place and stuff. You know,
outside Worcester.
People are smoking everywhere. Yeah. Like, what the heck's going on here, right? I mean, you're 13.
Yeah.
I can't believe they let me go to it. A year before, they wouldn't let me go see Robert Plant and the Black Crowes at the same place. So, yeah, it's a miracle they even let me go to this, but... That always stuck with me, that jing-jing, just the way it echoed. And then obviously, you know, he goes through the whole solo and you get the wood blocks and the xylophone and
the electric drums.
Bow, bow, bow. It's so musical. But the next year, there's another embarrassing story. I went back to that camp and I was like, okay, I'm going to play. We were like some stupid concert, right? I played a couple songs with a quote-unquote band. We played Sister Luck by the Black Crowes. We played All Along the Watchtower. And then
you were playing drums?
Yeah, not well, but just sort of very, yeah.
Okay.
And so I wanted to solo, or maybe they wanted me to do a solo. I was like, okay, I'm going to do this.
Oh, no.
And so, of course, like I started like that, and it was, but I didn't know what to do next, right? So the beginning, at least in my mind, was great. It sounded just like Neil at the beginning of his solo. But trust me, there was no point in which I was, you know, doing anything that sounds like this. But in my mind, Tom, I just imagined everybody cheering just like they were for Neil in his solo. So, yeah, that was a super embarrassing moment for me, but I'll always remember that. And then just speaking of Neil soloing, this is from, again, Exit Stage Left. I love his solo that he does in Exit Stage Left because he does it in the middle of YYZ. And I think I just have the – did I bring the just what, the end of this? Is that what I ended up here? Hold on.
Sure.
Let me see. Oh, and I have the beginning and the end of it. So this is him going from YYZ into the solo. All right, so that's...
Man, he really likes the snare drum, doesn't he?
Well, because I think
everything builds off that.
Right, because there's that, like, classic, like, hey, it all starts here. Everything else is sizzle. It starts with the ability to play on the snare.
That's also a big Buddy Rich thing.
Yes.
Buddy, if you watch a Buddy Rich solo, it all comes from the snare.
That's why I always think of Neil. I know he sort of calls out Keith Moon, but I always see this combination of Keith Moon and Buddy Rich and maybe even some John Bonham, where he kind of brings all of it together. But my favorite part of, I think, all of Exit Stage Left is when he comes back out of that solo into getting back into YYZ. He nails it, and the crowd just loses their mind at what they've just heard. The excitement that they have, right? And then you just think about how long in each show he's playing for, how exhausted he must be, and just the physical.
Yeah, the physical. When I was watching that video of the 92 solo there, he's probably in his mid-40s there, I guess. The physicality involved in just playing the drums 2 minutes of what he did, let alone a three-hour show or however long
it was. And
doing
that in the middle of it. It's remarkable.
Every night.
How about when we saw him a couple of years ago on the final tour? And you're like, how is he doing this?
I don't know.
And the fact that finding out later that he had already been diagnosed right at that point.
He had that foot problem.
It's really remarkable just to think about what a toll. And I think that's why nobody questioned this idea of, hey, Neil's bowing out. He didn't want to play anymore.
Right.
Okay, I get it. He's been working his butt off forever trying to do this. And I'm sure it just took a physical toll. I think that's why no one wondered, is he sick? I don't think I ever wondered about that. It was just, this is who he is.
And it never seemed like anybody held it against him, like he's quitting the band.
No.
It's just, all right, well, he can't play anymore.
He's done.
Yeah.
He's physically exhausted. So last clip, and then we just spend a moment or two. And I love this clip. It's again from Free Will, which I know is a popular song. I don't need to go deep tracks. I don't need to impress you with my knowledge and play, you know. It's just Free Will.
The Necromancer.
I was just listening to that the other day. Yeah, it's a really good song. And Dream Theater did a really cool cover of it.
That actually was good.
This is one of my favorite sections in any Rush song, and it's just because of all three guys essentially being insane at the same time, and it's sort of, would you call this the bridge coming out of the
solo?
Or it's the...
This is the solo.
Into the solo, rather, of Free Will. Man, that is...
Dude, don't you just hear smoke coming out of Alex's fingers there?
Yeah, but is there another solo from another band you can think of where the other two guys are doing what Neil and Geddy are doing while Alex is soloing?
Not really.
It's insane. It doesn't make sense.
Everybody is basically...
They're all soloing at the same time.
Kind of.
And it works. And it's in a pop song.
Yeah.
Pretty
remarkable. And again, it's that... That 6/8 thing that Neil...
You and I have always talked about this idea that I've had of doing a Rush podcast where you go through songs, choose a number one, number two, and number three star of that song.
Right, like Who Took the Skin.
Yeah, and Free Will's Impossible. Like, good luck. All three guys, what they're doing is just so remarkable in that song.
I don't know
how you possibly choose.
Who would you give that to?
Free Will? I gotta give a skin to one of the three. Yeah.
I think I have one definitive.
Alex?
Yeah.
It's gotta be
Alex. It's
Alex. That solo's pretty nuts.
The main riff of the song, and also all the bridges, the way it's... There's a lot of Alex there.
Why Neil Peart? Why?
You mean we should have gone with John Rutsey?
No, why didn't they stay with John Rutsey? Why? You know, tons of people have died. Tons of musicians have died. You and I have. Why does Neil Peart? And I don't think I've ever seen as much out. I mean, NBC, CBS, Fox the next week on all their football games. It's been everywhere.
Yeah, for a guy who isn't exactly mainstream, there's been a lot of outpouring.
Yeah.
So we watched all those playoff games over the weekend.
That's what I mean.
They were bumping out to commercial break with Limelight over and over. And
is it just that there's a Rush fan everywhere? What is it about?
Because
they had by far the biggest reception I've seen in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Not that people, that's something to live and die by. But when they went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it meant more than anybody else that I've seen get inducted. Their fans just always wanted them to be recognized, I think. And we spent most of our lives growing up with people like Bob telling us that Rush was annoying because they don't like Geddy's voice and they don't like the music. And everyone always said, well, I respect them because they're obviously great musicians. I just don't like the music. And all we ever wanted was to be like, to have them get some respect.
Right.
And when they went into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I think it meant more to Rush fans than any other band's fans.
I think, you think back to when you first started listening to them, man, them getting respect meant we're getting respect.
Right.
It's like, for once, we're going to be recognized. Again, when you're sitting there alone, and I wasn't like a depressed kid or anything, but my experience with Rush, maybe this is one of the reasons why I got emotional when he died, was almost like a solo experience. I went out and I would buy the CDs, but I'd listen to them on my boombox alone. And
sure.
So it was almost like a friend.
Yes. I didn't know anybody else really who liked Rush.
Yeah, I knew two other kids, but...
Is that who you went to go see them with?
Yes.
You're lucky.
Yes, both times.
I was so happy when I got to see Rush with you, because first time I saw him was with a guy named John McCumber, John McCumber. He didn't really know them, but he went with me just to go to a concert. Then I saw him with a friend of mine named Nicola. Then this girl I was had a crush on named Nina. They didn't care about him at all. They were just happy to go to a concert with me. I saw them with my friend Keith, which was great. Keith's a fan, but it's not like his thing. He's a great music fan. And then I saw them with some other friends who liked Rush. I saw him with Heather, who was nice enough to go with me to see when they played all of Moving Pictures.
Wow.
Which was great. That was such a cool show. I love that. I think it's my favorite show. But getting to see them with you, honestly, like, meant the world to me, because this was this band that I had essentially loved by myself.
By yourself.
As a solo experience my whole life. And I could share it with you. I loved that. It was so meaningful to me.
Well, that was awesome to, as I said on the air the other day, I think the only reason why I'm out here in Seattle is because when I first met you back in Connecticut, the first thing we ended up talking about for some reason was Rush.
Sure.
We figured that out about each other immediately. Like, how
we wear it on our sleeve, I guess.
Maybe we just smell each other or something. There's like a certain scent.
Yeah.
And so when you invited me out here, it was like, I trust this guy. I'm not kidding. Like,
it's cool.
If we didn't have Rush in common, would I have trusted you? I don't know if I would have. Maybe there's something about this band, something about their music, the fans, whatever it is, the culture of the band, where you just kind of know. You have that thing that's indescribable.
Mm.
And I think that, when they get inducted into the Hall of Fame, it validates all of that. Even though the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on its own, you can debate that till the cows come home, but it just means a little bit for that night.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
It's a really cool scene at the end, by the way, when they're all playing Crossroads together. And that's an awesome scene. Have you ever watched that? Their whole induction at the end of that whole ceremony. Everyone who was inducted that year, it's like Public Enemy and then Punji Guys, and Tom Morello's out there because he's like Mr. Hall of Fame guy.
Yeah, he's always there. So is Dave Grohl.
Dave Grohl's always there. Taylor Hawkins is there.
I saw that.
They're all playing Crossroads together, and it's just, it's really cool. It's a cool deal to see everybody out there and just sort of the smiles on everybody's face and kind of how it goes. Anyway, I don't know whether anyone in the world is, I don't know if this is going to get five people to listen to it. It's a nerdy Rush podcast, and mostly we sit around talking about sports. That's what we've done for a living.
Can you imagine for a second, because I do 15 hours a week, right? 3 hours a day.
Imagining Brock listening to this entire hour and a half?
Well, I could, actually. But I was going to say, can you imagine talking Rush for 15 hours a week?
I feel like we could, if you needed to.
For
a week? That'd be a lot.
15 hours a week, year round.
How about an hour a week? Oh, 15 hours a week. I think I could do an hour a day.
I probably could do that.
An hour a day,
but here's the thing with sports, there's new occurrences. Like, these guys are done.
That's true. They still have to be putting out a lot more music
right,
in order for us to do it. Anyway, this was a ton of fun for me. I really just enjoyed this. This was somewhat cathartic for me.
Me too.
I hope people will listen to it. I don't know. If they don't, I don't care. I'll be very happy to have just sat around and had an experience of talking about this with you, Tom. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for doing it. If you have made it all the way to this to the end here, thank you for staying with
us. Baby.
And listening.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. And yeah, that's it. An enormous thank you to Neil Peart, who was a titanic figure in my life in terms of music, and by far my favorite musician. I've only ever been affected by the deaths of two musicians, Bradley Nowell from Sublime when he died. That really hurt me. And Neil, who played a much bigger role in the amount of time and energy I spent, got me to play the drums, got me to quit the drums because I couldn't do it well enough, embarrassed me on more than one occasion, and helped me by letting me steal some poetry from him one time. So, Neil, thank you very much.